Let's Talk Development, Season 2, Episode 10.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Let's Talk Development, a podcast series by the CDPR. Today, we're going to be talking about water management and natural disasters in Pakistan. My name is Ayman Jalal. I'm a PhD student in economics at the London School of Economics. As part of my research, which is very generously supported by the IGC, I'm looking at the impact of natural disasters on rural poor households in Pakistan. This is co-authored work with Paul Simpson. We track the impacts of natural disasters on these poor households as they evolve over time and show that the consequences can be quite dynamic and require, as a result, policy that evolves as well over time. I have with me here as the guest of the podcast, Dr. Azim Ali Shah. He's a water governance professional with over 19 years of experience in conducting applied research for development projects in the South and Central Asia region. Dr. Azim's research focuses on a lot of topics that we're going to be discussing today, such as water security issues at the transboundary national levels, climate smart agricultural interventions that can improve water productivity and food security, automation systems for flow measurement, and solar-based irrigation systems for agricultural resilience. He's currently chief of party for a large US aid project with International Water Management Institute being implemented in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Azim.
Thank you very much, Ayman.
Let's get started by just talking a little bit about what is the major water issue that in your opinion, is being faced by Pakistan and how does it interact with climate change?
Okay, so in terms of the major water issue, we are facing major challenges with regards to water conservation, water distribution, and above all, water governance. Mm. These all issues are basically exacerbated by climate change. You know, Pakistan is one of the hotspots of climate change, and very relevant to the topic that we are discussing today. We have seen these erratic rainfall events in the recent mm-hmm. past. That 2022 flood was one of those events. So how we are to, let's say, govern or how we are to deal with these issues which are resulting due to abnormal behavior of climate in this part of the world, that's where, you know, water management has become critical. My sort of work in this field really started with 2010 floods. I was part of LUMS at that time doing my PhD. And, you know, this was one of the massive flood events that Pakistan had yeah. ever faced. I still remember, you know, there were news that 1/5 of the country was inundated, right. around 2,000 deaths that yeah. happened. But primarily that was a riverine flood.
Absolutely.
It was Indus that really yeah. could not, you know, it lost its track, basically, you know, the flood waters spread it into areas which were never ever envisaged as part mm-hmm. of the river or riverine areas. Mm-hmm. So as part of that work, I remember there was a tribunal that was constituted at the Lahore High Court, headed by Justice Mansoor Ali Shah. And I got a chance to work with that tribunal, and we went to all the flood affected areas across Punjab. Mm-hmm. And we met actually with the people who were affected. Right. And there were so many stories I still yeah. remember, I can recall that. But that has not stopped there. Yeah. The important thing is, after 2010, there was a flood in 2012, then there was a flood in 2014. Yeah. And also, you know, moving more recently to 2022. Mm-hmm. But the nature of the devastation or nature of the damages have changed.
Yeah.
You see, in 2022, it was not a major riverine flood.
Yeah.
It was a flood that occurred into different parts of the country, yeah. mainly as a result of torrential rains
yeah.
that resulted into flash floods.
Yeah.
And those flash floods really damaged a lot of the property, livestock, yeah. you know, houses, roads, bridges. So that has as a real toll on the economic side of things. 2022 flood, again, you know, in terms of the proportion of the land that it covered, I mean, the reports are around 1/3 of the yeah. land was inundated, and the major devastation occurred in Balochistan and Sindh. And the reason is, you know, the topography of those areas is rather
flat
as,
yeah.
as compared to what you have seen in 2020 flood, where KPK was the major, mm-hmm. You know, hotspot of the affected areas. So, you know, why these kind of phenomena we are facing again and again, and, you know, climate change impacts, that is where we need to have very serious discussion.
Yeah.
And how to deal with it, it is where, you know, water governance comes in.
Absolutely. So let's start by talking about the 2010 floods. As you said, 2022 was a rather unprecedented event, but 2010 had to do with our water management. So to what extent was that foreseeable, and what could we have done differently to prevent the kinds of damages that we experienced then?
So my experience with the tribunal findings and a lot of hearings that we had to have with different departments, one thing which was very clear, we were not prepared. You know,
okay.
We thought that it would be another monsoon season, you know,
yeah.
It would be rains, you know, a bit higher than the normal. But the problem started when the Met Department even did not properly issued the advisories
mm-hmm.
to see or to show the intensity of the rains that were coming. So Irrigation Department is the primary custodian of our canal structure. They were also not well prepared.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a SOP that, you know, on 15th of, let's say, June every year, they have to stop any work on any of the barrage or canal infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
and they have to start preparing for the flood,
mm-hmm.
Which requires them to monitor the embankments. They have to, you know, wet the channels in order to see whether they would be able to withstand any
mm-hmm.
shear forces that come along with the flood water. So a lot of those things were overlooked,
okay.
Right? Then obviously the rains were unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
The water that came in as a result of those rainfall event, it crossed the safety sort of thresholds of many of our barrages on
mm-hmm.
Indus. There were water more than 1 million cusics
mm-hmm.
Recorded, let's say, at Tonsa Barrage mm-hmm. and then downstream, upstream on Chashma as well. Jinnah was also affected. So the devastation mainly occurred because of the breach of the embankments at Jinnah and then at Tonsa Barrage. And that water then spread it into an area of, you know, thousands of miles across, you know, the whole Indus
mm-hmm.
in the country. So the learning was that, you know, the SOPs have to be properly followed. We have to be very sort of precise in terms of our advisories.
Yeah.
That, you know, what could be the magnitude of the flood. And, you know, there are certain nomenclature that is followed.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you know, high flood, very high flood, extremely
mm-hmm.
high flood. So these are
mm-hmm.
typical nomenclature, and accordingly, it triggers what kind of action you have to take.
Right.
So since then, up till now, what I have seen that has improved,
okay,
Met
that's
Department,
good to know.
Met Department has been very vigilant in terms
okay.
of issuing the advisories. Irrigation Department has also improved, particularly in Punjab, their operations. They constituted a flood risk and assessment unit.
Mm-hmm.
They do now inundation modeling as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what kind of magnitude could result in what kind of inundation in the mm-hmm. adjoining areas near to the river. They also, you know, have better SOPs. Obviously, you know, there were certain actions that were recommended.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say that all have been sort of incorporated in their revised operations, but the improvement has occurred.
And what are the barriers to implementing all of the recommended SOPs? Like, why do you think we're
so
still lagging?
Barriers, you know, there are multiple barriers. I would say some are institutional barriers. People, you know, are used to carry out certain jobs in a certain manner.
Right, okay.
So that needs a behavioral change.
So there's some path dependence to, like,
yes,
older ways of
yes.
doing things.
Some are the barriers which require a lot of investment.
Okay.
So investment into, let's say, physical structures,
right.
investment into procurement of equipment, machinery,
yeah.
That also sometime, you know, result in terms of not properly prepared before the flood season. Then also, they do not have the capacity in-house to carry out proper modeling or forecasting. They rely on multiple other departments.
Okay.
And when the flood event occurs, typically, you know, there is often a reactive mode that kicks
right.
in. That shouldn't be the case, because
we
have
more
seen
anticipatory. Yeah,
exactly. We have seen many of those events where, you know, there are lots and lots of learnings. I remember in the 2010 flood inquiry report, the title was very interesting. A Rude Awakening was the title of that report. And in that Rude Awakening report, we delegated, I guess, a couple of chapters for the policymakers, how they can be well prepared in terms of the future similar events if they are to take place.
Okay.
And we have seen similar events, but the preparation has not been up to the mark. So this is what I see. Recently in 2022, because the nature of the flood was different,
yeah,
it was not in a single river.
Yeah,
it was not the Indus flood.
Yeah,
so a lot of other things that then came into, you know, picture was that, you know, the farmers whose land were affected were stranded.
Yeah.
A lot of better water management practices that could have been in place would have led them not to suffer that much, which they eventually did. For example, you know, we have been working in an area in Dera Ismail Khan region.
Mm-hmm.
Under the Water Management for Enhanced Productivity activity supported by USAID. And in that activity, we introduced raised bed cropping for the first time in that area.
Okay.
And would you imagine that, you know, before the flood, we carry out a modeling exercise that, you know, what could be the possible flood magnitude in the future years in this particular area. And we anticipated very correctly that, you know, 2022, according to the modeling exercise that we have carried out, a flood is expected of high magnitude.
Okay.
So that eventually happened.
Right.
And, you know, the only farmers who were better off, you know, their crops were less damaged as compared to the other farmers, were the farmers who had this raised bed technology, because the water did not pond it there. It drained into the beds. So some very, very, you know, small interventions can really save the livelihood of farmers.
Yeah.
There is a technology which we call laser grading, for instance. If you give a slight grade in the soil while preparing it for cultivation, that can also help to drain water rather than ponding. You know, the myth that we have to laser level every field and we'll have huge productivity, it is entirely wrong.
Okay.
I mean, it is only sort of helpful where you need to pond water.
Mm.
And with the kind of crisis we have in terms of the water management or the water scarcity for that matter, less and less water would be available to majority of the stakeholders. So we have to rationalize how we have to use that water.
Right.
And in terms of rationalizing, I would also like to emphasize here is that we have to take water out of agriculture. I mean, it would sound very,
controversial statement.
Controversial statement. But see, in majority of the developed world or even the developing countries, nobody is using more than 90% of the water in agriculture.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any economic sense.
Mm.
You have to assess the value of water based on the contribution to the GDP.
Yeah.
For instance, livestock sector, industries, they are contributing more as compared to the agriculture
sector.
So accordingly, I'm not saying that we bring from 90 to 50 or 30% like in the developed economies, but the better threshold level is around 70%.
Okay.
So we have to phase out in terms of, you know, reducing water in agriculture and accordingly allocating it to the other competing sectors. But that would only happen if we improve the water use efficiency in the agriculture sector.
Yeah.
For that, we have a long history of working from the platform of International Water Management Institute as well, along with the USAID support, for instance, in the project that I mentioned. So a lot of these practices, for instance, high efficiency irrigation systems, solar based irrigation systems, they are designed in a way that they consume very less amount of water as per the crop water requirements.
Okay.
So there is a science behind it. And that science is known by the farmers, by the way.
Yeah,
they
that's
know,
interesting.
They know that, you know, how much water would really help them to grow a better crop.
Yeah.
The only problem is that, you know, their access to certain those technologies or information or machinery for that matter is limited, either by virtue of not having the capital to procure that, or just because that nobody has ever tried to reach them.
Okay.
To educate them.
So I wanted, on that topic, I want to go back to some of the interventions that you said that you've piloted, for example, in Dia Khan, like the raised beds. I think there's a big literature in economics and agricultural science in general, which is that it's sometimes hard to get farmers to adopt new innovations and adaptation approaches. Sometimes it's because they lack, as you said, the resources to do it. But what you're describing are quite cheap interventions, it sounds like, and you seem to have had success in getting farmers to adopt some of these practices. So can you talk us through, yeah, how you achieved that? How did you communicate with them? What were the barriers to adoption, and how did you overcome them?
So my experience working in this sector is that, you know, you have to show farmers the benefit of any technology or any new practice. Once they see it actually, you know, happening in the field, mm-hmm. it would automatically then basically spread across many other farmers, many other places. For instance, in Deer Khan, I mentioned that, you know, it used to be a traditional spate irrigation system. So okay. spate irrigation is basically the water comes from the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
You spread it across the fields.
Okay.
The water is ponded. Then the water percolates in the field.
Right.
And after that, you know, there's enough moisture that they would grow a crop like wheat in the
mm-hmm.
winter, and they don't need to even irrigate.
Okay.
Right. So that was primarily the practice in that particular
okay.
area. So a new dam that was constructed in South Waziristan, its name is Gumazam Dam,
okay.
With USAID support, and Pakistan government also pitched in their money. So after the construction of that dam, there was a canal irrigation system that
mm-hmm.
was laid out in that area of Deer Khan, Tang, Kolachi, all
mm-hmm.
of these districts. Farmers were still used to using the spate irrigation.
Yeah.
What they would do is they would take a section from the water course out, divert the water through the field, let it pond,
mm-hmm.
and they would grow one crop a year.
Yeah.
So that is the challenge that we were posed by
yeah.
By the development partner, that you have to change these practices.
Yeah.
So the only way we could figure out was actually, you know, bringing in these new practices of preparing land that
mm-hmm.
included raised bed. We also promoted drip irrigation systems there.
Mm-hmm.
We involved even the women who are very conservative in that particular area, but with them we installed solar-based drip irrigation kits for micro or, you know, sort of kitchen gardening purposes.
Mm-hmm.
We even helped them to prepare solar-based spray machines.
Okay.
Then we also realized there is a challenge there that, you know, during the lean season, when you do not have enough rainfall or water
mm-hmm.
available, there was shortage of fodder for
mm-hmm.
animals. So there is a technique which is called silage making,
mm-hmm.
Through which you basically prepare fodder that can be used for longer period of time for the livestock purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So all these techniques, we actually, you know, involved farmers. We
mm-hmm.
carried out on their fields. When they saw actually, you know, things are working and they are earning better as compared to the fellow farmers, automatically we did not have to do any
anything,
marketing, any campaigning.
Everything
was, you know, kind of like a wildfire. It spread in that particular area.
That's great.
So it's seeing is believing. And with farmers,
mm-hmm.
my experience is that, you know, if you involve them, if you teach them how to, let's say, get better productivity out of their land and water, they are always receptive.
Yeah, everyone's incentives are then aligned. So you basically got them to take a leap of faith in a pilot, and then it sort of scaled up on its
mm.
own once it started to see the benefits. That's great. You also talked about how we need to essentially change the crop mix for it to become a more water efficient country. And, you know, tying that to our original topic, I often think about how, especially in Sindh where I work, that for the between 2010 and 2022, there have been these sharp swings between drought in 1 year and then like total flooding in the next year, which makes it very difficult, not just for farmers, but also for policymakers to know what to actually prescribe. Because
mm-hmm.
in a weather that is that unpredictable, it's very hard to figure out what is the right crop mix, what are the right adaptation strategies. So A, can you say a little bit about what's thinking on how to deal with these very unpredictable weather changes and weather shocks year after year? And then what would be the right type of crop mix, irrigation investment? And are we talking to farmers about how to adapt to this climate?
I guess there are two or three parts of this question. First is, again, take the example of 2022. There was a heat wave before the monsoon
yeah.
season in 2022. So everybody was talking about drought-like condition, right?
Yeah.
Then there was unprecedented rain. So it resulted in huge flood.
Yeah.
In between, there was obviously a shift in the sort of season. You know, we saw winters not starting at the time when they were supposed to start.
Yeah.
You know, they were ending at a time when they were not supposed to end.
And last year, I think there was a mix of both heat waves and flooding. And exactly. It was just like a double whammy of like the worst types of things that you could experience.
So the first part is that, you know, in order to cope up with these weather change patterns, you ought to have some resilience in the system. For the water system, I would imagine that, you know, you have to have enough storages, which are able to provide, let's say, surface water supplies during the lean season. We do not have enough storages, right? Then there is a buffer, which is groundwater, right? So there is no strict regulation or policy on groundwater. Everybody who owns a land can extract groundwater by digging a tube well, right? And that groundwater contribution has exceeded now the surface water contribution in agriculture. So that is where we also need to think through how we are going to control the groundwater abstraction, because that's a buffer available to you only till the time you have enough recharge of the aquifer happening. If the recharge is not happening, that buffer is going to erode automatically. And we have seen in case of Balochistan where the groundwater levels have reached to, let's say, 1500 feet, which is not economically viable, which is not you know, something that you can rely on in the future years. So one thing, we have to build resilience of the system in terms of, you know, having ample supply of the resource, and then obviously efficiently using that resource. We cannot rely on the flood irrigation that has been happening for years and years. There are techniques in order to improve flood irrigation. For instance, we call it precision surface irrigation, whereby you use the flood irrigation type technique, but you use less water just by preparing the land better.
Okay.
The second part of your question about the cropping pattern, there's a lot of literature on virtual export of water. And that is to do with like growing crops like rice, maize, for instance. They are water intensive crops. We cannot afford in the future really to expand the areas under sugarcane cultivation or rice cultivation, because these are water intensive crops. And at the end of the day, we have to ensure our food security, not to really worry about the food security or, you know, luxury of exporting these type of crops to other countries. So this cropping pattern and zoning of different regions based on the water availability, whether these are the arid arid lands or whether they are canal fed lands, that has to be carried out. And then strict measures has to be taken in order that, you know, people only grow those crops which are viable for those particular regions. We can't prescribe a excellent crop mix or pattern. It is obviously farmers' choice.
Right.
They sometimes prefer to grow vegetables as compared to, you know, traditional crops like cotton, wheat, or maize, or sugarcane. So the crops that, you know, give them more benefit as in terms of the output, in terms of the revenue, that is obviously the natural choice. But if we have some sort of regulation in place whereby we can define, and this was particularly, you know, in the past followed, for instance, for sugar industry, there were certain areas which were limited that, you know, you can have sugar mills there. But in the past few years or decades, we have seen that, you know, the area which was primarily cotton growing area in the south of Punjab, I'm talking about Rahimia Khan and the adjoining areas, that have converted now from cotton growing area to sugarcane. And there are lots and lots of sugar mills there. So that is not sustainable. That is the issue, that, you know, we can't let any industry flourish on the cost of, let's say, depleting our natural resources.
Right.
What was the third part of the question?
I guess one thing that I'm wondering based on what you just said is that there seemed to, like, we've experienced the 2010 floods. We then experienced some sporadic floods afterwards. And then the 22 floods hopefully were a wake-up call 12 years later again to really take these issues seriously. You've just, like, noted that there are a lot of adaptation strategies. There's a lot of literature out there, and that farmers will be, you know, receptive to adopting these if someone communicates the advantages of them well. So what is happening in the policy circle since 2022? So I know that there is a lot of effort devoted to reconstruction. So, you know, houses are being rebuilt. We're thinking a little bit about how social protection can help react to these crises. But beyond reconstruction, what is happening in terms of prevention, anticipation? What is happening on those fronts in the policy circles? Is the government thinking about it? And what kinds of actions are being considered?
So a lot of emphasis these days is the implementation of the provincial water acts that have been recently passed in Punjab, in KP, Sindh is also prepared there. So under those acts, water has not become the mandate of only, let's say, irrigation department.
Okay.
They are considering water resources management as a sort of integral part, or integrated water resources management for that matter. That would include not only, you know, the water for irrigation, but also for the potable supply, for industries, also including the groundwater management. So the hope that I have with these acts in place, and under those acts, they have constituted these water resources regulatory authorities. They have a water commission where, you know, representatives from all the stakeholders, they sit in. They take the high level decisions, and these are then operationalized through the water resources regulatory authorities. So the good thing that is happening is these are now actually, you know, functioning. A lot of these issues which were not looked after in the past, they are now under discussion. For instance, IWMI has helped them, the Punjab Regulatory Authority, to implement the groundwater management information system for the whole Punjab. They are working on the same lines with the KP
and irrigation department. And what do these systems capture?
So the systems capture basically, you know, one is the inventory of tube wells we have across the province, the depth of the water, how that is changing over the period of time, the quality of water, how that is being changing over the period of time. And then we can visually sort of analyze what are the hot spots where we really need to focus on in terms of either we have to promote further agriculture based on groundwater use in that particular area, or we have to, let's say, take corrective measures that, you know, you can't take more tube wells in that particular area. The other side of the story is the solar based irrigation system, the proliferation of the solar tube wells. And that is a technology that has become so inexpensive that, you know, majority of the farmers are installing solar tube wells. The interesting part on this is you would hear in the mainstream media also, and also, you know, in the popular press, that solar-based tube wells are leading to groundwater depletion. So that is the headline sort of you would read everywhere, which is not true. We had a project from Swiss Development Corporation on the solar-based irrigation systems, and we investigated with very detailed surveys in three different districts in Punjab, for instance, in Rahimia Khan, in Jhang, in Chakwal district, in north, center, and south. And we realized that, you know, the solar-based tube wells are not extracting more water as compared to diesel or electric tube wells, because the horsepower or the size of the tube wells is smaller as compared to the electric or diesel tube wells. The only farmers who were extracting more water were having multiple tube wells, like they had a solar pump as well, they had a diesel pump as well, they had an electric pump as well. In majority of the cases, that was not the issue, because, you know, those who have completely shifted towards solar, they could only use that pump during the light hours, right? 6 hours maximum on average we have solar electricity that we can generate. But the diesel or the electric tube wells give you luxury that you can sort of run that in the night as well, right?
Yeah.
So some of these systems that have been recently institutionalized in, let's say, Punjab, and that KP is also working on that, these would really help to take decisions at the commission level that, you know, where to promote and how to promote. And again, it is across sectors. It is not limited to irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
The mandate of the commission regulatory authorities under this act is across, let's say, industry for recreational purposes, for portable water supplies. Because in future, we have to divert water from our, you know, rivers or from the surface water resources for portable supply as well.
Mm-hmm.
The groundwater-based portable supply systems are not sustainable. We have huge decline of the water table, and obviously this is not an infinite resource. It's a limited resource.
Right.
So after a certain time, you know, the aquifer cannot provide you fresh water.
Yeah.
The saline water intrudes in.
Yeah, and this groundwater management issue and the conservation of groundwater has, you know, been a problem for a while. What are the major barriers that prevent the government from taking action? Is it political interests? Is it coordination across provinces? Is it monitoring? Is just too costly? What do you think is holding us back there?
So my take on this is it's from the colonial era.
Okay.
There was an easement act, it is called. And under that act, basically, if you own a land, you can dig a tube well.
Yeah.
So it is basically the right of the person, you know, holding the land that they can dig tube well. So this has not been revoked or repealed up till now.
And it's too political to try and revoke that. Is that your concern?
It is also a political constraint as well, that, you know, if you can, let's say, bring in a new regulation, not to allow, although licensing has been started in Punjab.
Okay.
Tube well water licensing has been started in Punjab, but the enforcement of that licensing mechanism is very difficult in the presence of particularly that easement act, whereby you know, you can dig a well. For instance, if you are constructing a house and if you want to install a groundwater pump, you can do that. There are, I guess, certain restrictions. For instance, in some of the societies, or, you know, in some of the territories, but in majority of the cases, nobody can sort of stop you from abstracting groundwater if it is available. If it's not available, you know, obviously you are constrained. So a major issue has been this. Otherwise, you know, it's also difficult if you know, private land has a tube well, how can you go there and you can stop that person to abstract groundwater?
Right.
So it is more of a regulatory problem. It is more of an enforcement issue also. But it is now being increasingly realized that, you know, the way we have been abstracting groundwater, that is not sustainable. And in terms of sustaining groundwater, there are some very good practices that have been sort of institutionalized, particularly in the capital, in Islamabad, whereby a lot of groundwater recharge wells have been installed by CDA, more than 100.
Okay.
We have also installed a few of these wells in Peshawar and Islamabad. And these really help to replenish the groundwater through the excess water that comes from rain.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, rainwater harvesting has been institutionalized in CDA, and in Lahore also they are trying to promote it. So there are certain measures that we can take in order to conserve the groundwater. But these are, again, at a very small level currently.
Yeah.
For the larger perspective, we have to really sort of think through how we are going to, let's say, deal with this issue of groundwater over abstraction.
And some of the water management practices that we've talked about are more steady state, like when things are calm and we have some time to reevaluate our resources and, you know, the flow of water, we can take some actions. But going back to our original topic of crisis response, I wonder, when the 2022 floods happened, because the magnitude was so unforeseeable, I think some of the thinking is that there's really not much that we could have done to contain that kind of water. Like the water was just there for 8 months and you just have to wait for it to evaporate. And, you know, we can cut ourselves some slack by saying, look, there's nothing that we could have done to prepare for something like that. But now we do know from that event that we're in an era where that type of thing could happen again. And it's probably not a 100-year event anymore. So knowing that now, what can we do in terms of water policy to respond to such crises of a very large scale?
So we have a National Flood Protection Plan that has been recently approved. That has a lot of these, you know, answers for these questions, whereby there are structural measures that have been proposed. The drainage system, particularly in Sindh and Balochistan, that has to be reworked out, you know.
So
there are measures, some are in the short term, some are in the medium term, some are in the long term. Just imagine if they are all put in place, right? Would we not see similar things in the future? I would question that, because you know, the magnitude and intensity of these events we have seen are increasing, you know, with the passage of time. So with you know, all the infrastructure that you can put in place, I don't think that, you know, we are well positioned to minimize the damages that come as a result of these floods. The important thing in dealing with these disasters are the nature-based solutions. It is also, you know, getting a lot of prominence these days, whereby you the more you play with the nature, the more the nature is going to respond to you, right? So a lot of these non-structural type interventions, for instance, wetland restoration, afforestation, and you know, not damming the water, but you know, trying to conserve water underground. It's the largest resource of water, the water that is underground. There are techniques how to promote underground restoration or recharge of water. So a lot of these nature-based solutions that are, you know, in place in many other geographies, in many parts of the world, they are currently being promoted in Pakistan. I know for sure that, you know, there's a large GCF-funded project which has been given to Worldwide Fund for Nature, WWF. They have started working on that. The major component is to, you know, introduce nature-based solutions to deal with these catastrophes of flood, for instance, heat waves for that matter, drought-like conditions. So there is work going on. It will take some time, but we have to be better prepared in terms of our response. And that would not only, you know, sort of come from structural interventions. We have to build our institutional capacity in terms of better forecasting, better messaging, better coordination, and also, you know, the responsibilities that are given to different departments. The one issue that I reflect the 2010 episode was departments were even not aware that, you know, certain response or function was under their mandate. They would imagine that, you know, it is the district government responsibility that they have to evacuate people, right? It is army's responsibility to, let's say, provide support to the flood affected victims. It is NDMA's. So all these NDMA's and, you know, PDMA's were not functional at that time. Only NDMA existed, PDMA's were not existent at all. So now these NDMA's and PDMA's have also evolved over the period of time. So,
did you think that things were better when the 2022 floods came around as a result?
As compared to 2010,
I
believe it was better. If that would have been a riverine flood of the same magnitude,
then they would have been
prepared. I would imagine that the destruction that it unleashed would have been lesser as compared to 2010. But because the nature of the flood was different, it was not a pure riverine flood. It was more of a result of flash flooding, and in that too in different areas across the country. So that was something that we were not prepared for. In future, if that happens in the near future, I don't think you will have better response. But in the long run, let's say in 5 years' time or more, I think there are now realization that, you know, these events would occur again and again. And we have to have certain sort of better practices in place. And for that, you know, this nature-based solutions type approach, I think this is the way to go.
So I think let's conclude maybe on a slightly more positive note, and I think you've already kind of led us in this direction. I do think that it is, we're asking a lot of a poor country to evolve very old systems and resources in response to risks that keep changing. You know, we prepare for a riverine flood and then we have a huge rain-induced flood that was unprecedented. perhaps in the last minute or so, maybe you can talk about some things that give you hope, like that in the future, as these risks are becoming more known, maybe there's more appetite to do stuff. You know, I know climate financing is a huge barrier. Maybe we're able to unlock more of it than we were able to in 2010. Is there anything to look forward to?
No, I still believe we have to be very optimistic, because there's a lot of focus now from the development partners. For instance, ADB, World Bank, they are already financing the government of Punjab and government of Pakistan at the federal level as well on dealing with the flash floods.
Yeah.
In terms of the hill torrents, for instance.
Yeah.
Hill torrents have never been the sort of emphasis of any investment back in 2010. USAID has recently announced a new funding opportunity. It's a large funding opportunity. And the focus again is on these three topics that we are discussing today, on hill torrent management, on urban flooding, and also rural livelihoods. So a lot of these donors, I know for sure, are investing in terms of building the capacity of the government to deal with these issues. On the government front, I think we have also sort of evolved over the period of time. The government institutions, you know, back in 2010 or earlier, as compared to what I see now with the passage of these water acts and new regulations being proposed, at least the institutional architecture has become a bit better. And the only thing that I would expect and hope would be that, you know, the kind of measures or the kind of interventions that they have proposed are actually implemented, and then the enforcement comes in. So if that all happens, I think we would have better outcomes.
We'd have done the best that we could, at least.
And obviously, you know, the last thing that I would like to say is the climate-induced disasters are not because of our own let's say doings that we have been doing in the past 70 or 80 years. It has to do for you know, the things that have been done beyond our borders, right?
And that's why it's a big ask. You know, it's like, we didn't contribute to this problem, and the problem that we're facing changes every day. Like, we're dealing with a heat wave in one season and a flood in the other, and are expected to evolve very rapidly, something that more developed countries would struggle to. So we have to give ourselves some grace, but at the end of the day, the reality is remains that we have to take action, and because we're the ones who are affected, and that's just the unfortunate reality of our country.
And I hope, you know, some of these commitments under the loss and damage fund or the climate finance, you know, the recent COP29 type commitments also, these come through. And you know, we also prepare ourselves, we change our lifestyles, we try to, let's say, advocate for the conservation of water. Because the water, since Pakistan gained independence up till now, it has been the same almost, you know, the availability of water. It's mainly the population growth that has resulted in terms of the per capita availability of water. So if that availability is consistent, we have to rationalize the use of water. And that's where all this debate about water governance and management is.
All right, so let's wrap up there. Thank you so much, Dr. Azim Perk, for talking to us about all of the interventions that you have tried, all of the things that give us some hope that in the future we'd hopefully be better prepared to deal with some of these natural disasters. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.